Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There's a high possibility that they may not be able to fish, with 2023 being the fourth year.
After years of subsistence salmon closures, federal fisheries authorities inch forward on limiting bycatch. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a new bill would change veterinarians' access to human medical records.
There are far more people that are dying from fentanyl overdoses and other types of medications, and they're not coming from veterinary clinics.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Proposals to limit chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea are moving ahead, but slowly. Supporters of bycatch limits say reducing the accidental catch of chum and Chinook salmon in the Bering Sea could help improve runs along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. After 3 years of no subsistence chum and Chinook harvest, Western Alaskans are frustrated with the process, while pollock trawlers are resistant to further regulation. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
After reviewing recommendations over the weekend, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council asked for further analysis to help develop possible bycatch regulations. It's a small step in a slow federal fishery management process. Melissa Johnson is Government Affairs and Policy Director for the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Tribal Consortium and a member of the Council's advisory panel. She says while the council is moving in the right direction, the motion doesn't immediately address villages along the Yukon and Kuskokwim that have been hit hardest by the chum and Chinook crashes.
Indigenous people who have provided testimony where they have not been able to fish for 3 years, there's a high possibility that they may not be able to fish, with 2023 being the fourth year.
The Western Alaska salmon crash is likely driven by a number of factors, including climate change. It's not certain new bycatch limits would improve the runs, since only about 10% of chum intercepted in the Bering Sea are headed for Western Alaska, according to genetic studies. But the council's motion acknowledges that the Bering Sea pollock trawl fishery is responsible for keeping some proportion of chum salmon from returning to Alaska rivers. Chinook bycatch limits are already in place in the Bering Sea. Brent Payne, executive director of United Catcher Boats, says the idea of adding chum bycatch limits is scary for the groundfish trawlers he represents. He says the impact to trawlers depends on what the council ultimately decides, but the most restrictive proposals could close the fishery.
The Eastern Bering Sea pollock fishery is one of the largest valuable fisheries in the world. So there will be huge losses, huge revenue losses, and lots of jobs lost.
The Bering Sea and Aleutian Island pollock fishery was valued at almost $450 million in 2019, according to a NOAA fisheries report. Payne noted that the fishery supports coastal communities with processing plants like Dutch Harbor, Akutan, and Sand Point. Tim Bristol, executive director of the pro-subsistence advocacy organization Salmon State, says while the council is making progress toward bycatch limits, he's disappointed with its process, which he says prioritizes the pollock fishery above subsistence harvesters.
You have this industry that I think the government, via the council, sees as too big to fail. And I just worry that that has really disturbing implications for everybody else who counts on that ecosystem for their livelihood and their way of life.
Meanwhile, last week, Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Association of Village Council Presidents, represented by Earth Justice, filed a lawsuit against the National Marine Fisheries Service, arguing that current federal fishery management plans are outdated and don't adequately prioritize the needs of subsistence users. Kate Glover, senior attorney at Earth Justice, says they're pushing for the agency to consider different ways to approach fisheries management.
That might include things like looking at changes in bycatch or what could be done as far as catch limits go and how that affects other fish that are not being targeted by the fisheries but are important to subsistence users.
The analysis the council requested will go through a series of reviews and public comment periods. Final action on the proposals is scheduled for June 2024. If a bycatch limit does pass, it won't be active until the 2025 season. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
State officials are resurrecting a Labor Department program to help immigrants gain employment in Alaska as hundreds of Ukrainian refugees are resettling here after fleeing their war-torn homeland. The legislature passed a law more than 20 years ago establishing the Office of Citizenship Assistance within the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, but it closed after a few years. Acting Labor Commissioner Kathy Munoz says the office is back as of today after refugee assistance providers at Catholic Social Services had asked for more help from the state.
I think it's really a unique opportunity to really connect individuals to training and employment resources and really trying to help to coordinate those activities.
Munoz says the state is in need of skilled workers, particularly those with certification for commercial driving, as federal infrastructure funds flow to Alaska and construction ramps up. But there are often barriers, bureaucratic or otherwise, for immigrants seeking employment after arriving in the state. Munoz says the Office of Citizenship Assistance will help them overcome those hurdles as well as other challenges that come with resettling in a new country. Deputy Commissioner Nelson San Juan is leading the office and says as an immigrant himself from the Philippines, the work was important enough to lure him out of retirement.
For them to see me leading this team, it means a lot to them. It gives them hope that, he's also, I can see myself on this guy, you know.
Munoz says about 500 Ukrainian refugees have already settled in Alaska, with another 250 expected this year and 200 more next year. And Munoz stresses that the Office of Citizenship Assistance aims to help any immigrant to Alaska, whether they're from Ukraine or anywhere else. According to new census data, more than 2,000 people moved to Alaska from other countries last year. A bill that would exempt Alaska veterinarians from registering with the state's prescription drug database is being considered in the legislature. Soldotna Republican Representative Justin Ruffridge sponsored the bill and presented it to the Senate's Labor and Commerce Committee this week. KDLL's Riley Board is in Juneau and has this story.
A database designed to curb overdose deaths in the state is creating a headache for medical professionals who don't work with human patients. Veterinarians say the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, or PDMP, is a regulatory hassle, creates privacy concerns, and just doesn't apply to veterinary medicine. Soldotna Representative Justin Ruffridge is sponsoring a bill that would exempt vets statewide from the program. A state law in 2008 created the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. In 2017, in response to rising rates of opioid use in the state, it became mandatory for medical providers who provide or administer scheduled substances to report to PDMP. Veterinarian Jim Delker co-owns Twin Cities Veterinary Clinic in Soldotna with his wife.
There are far more people that are dying from fentanyl overdoses and other types of medications, and they're not coming from veterinary clinics. They're coming from, you know, illicit sources of drugs. That's where we need to focus our resources at. But on the veterinary side, the PDMP is not doing what it was intended to do.
Delker is a longtime advocate for the veterinary exemption and says the reporting system is a major drain on the clinic's staff. He says the PDMP just isn't designed for vets.
Animals don't have identifiers. They don't have social security numbers, and in the way of actually, you know, driver's licenses are ways that we can identify each one as they come in.
Because of this, vets instead look at the prescription histories of the humans who brought them in, posing a major privacy issue for pet owners.
For instance, if you were to bring in your pet, I would be looking at your drug history of controlled substances, not just opioids, anything that's considered a controlled substance. So that might include anti-anxiety meds, it might include hormone replacements, it might include a number of different things that are controlled substances that I don't really have any need to have access to.
Because the pet owner vet relationship is not bound by HIPAA, Delker says it creates an unnecessary gray area for vets. Delker also says vets dispense very few opioids or other drugs that are sought out for prescription. When vets use controlled substances like opioids, it's usually in the clinic, in a surgical capacity. There are 33 other states that exempt veterinarians from reporting, many that have made the same switch the bill is proposing. Ruffridge's bill passed the House overwhelmingly last month, and today he presented the bill to the other chamber's Labor and Commerce Committee, chaired by Nikiski Senator Jesse Bjorkman. A similar bill, sponsored by Senator Roger Holland, passed the Senate last year, but didn't make it out of the House. There are just over 5 weeks left in the session for the legislature to pass the bill. In Juneau, I'm Riley Board.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Ketchikan officials consider whether to allow Drag Queen Story Hour to return to the library.
I think sometimes we forget that like any form of art form can be for children or for adults.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Drag Queen Storytime is set to return to the Ketchikan Public Library this June as part of the library's Pride Month festivities. That's according to the library's director. It would be the library's second time hosting a drag queen for a reading, but as KRBD's Eric Stone reports, Ketchikan City Manager, who oversees the library director, says no final decision has been made.
Last June, the Ketchikan Public Library held its first ever Drag Queen Storytime to celebrate Pride Month. The event was so popular that the library had to add two additional readings to accommodate everyone who wanted to attend. But the library's decision to host a drag queen for Storytime sparked weeks of debate among community members and elected officials. The council ultimately voted 5-2 to allow the event to go forward as planned. And it was a hit, according to Library Director Pat Tully at the time.
This, I think, is probably the biggest story time we've ever had.
But the backlash continued after the reading, and it spurred a ballot proposition aiming to defund Ketchikan's library. The sponsor said the push was at least partly inspired by the drag queen reading. The measure was tied to a tax on rural residents, and only residents of the traditionally conservative precincts outside of Ketchikan and Saxman city limits were eligible to vote. Still, voters ultimately rejected the proposal by a 13-point margin. Planning for this year's Pride celebration at the library started shortly after last year's Storytime event. But Tully said in a recent interview that earlier this year, City Manager Delilah Walsh told her that the library should not play a direct role in hosting a Drag Queen Storytime.
That it shouldn't be something that the library sponsored. That it was totally fine as any nonprofit group can come in and use the large meeting room, reserve the large meeting room, but that the library shouldn't sponsor it.
Tully said that by not sponsoring the event, Walsh hoped to address the concerns of people who opposed last year's reading.
I believe the idea was that the city needed to be responsive to the entire community, including those who felt had some concerns about a drag queen story time.
As of Friday afternoon, Walsh had not addressed KRBD's repeated requests to discuss internal deliberation surrounding Drag Queen Storytime. That move prompted the Ketchikan Pride Alliance, a local LGBTQ education and outreach nonprofit, to send a letter to Walsh asking for an explanation. J.D. Martin is the group's president.
The Ketchikan Pride Alliance's mission is to provide education, support, and aid to the local LGBTQ community and their allies. And so we do a lot of and support, free training, education. Our goal is to reduce conflict in the community. So when we heard about this, we thought it might be valuable for us to seek some clarification from the city manager.
On Friday, Tully said Walsh changed course and gave the library the go-ahead to sponsor a story reading featuring a drag queen. But late Friday afternoon, Walsh told KRBD in an email that no final decision had been made. She did not immediately address the apparent contradiction between her statement and that of the library director. Tommy Varela-Cossack was the star of last year's Storytime, reading the book The Hips on the Drag Queen Go Swish, 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 as his drag alter ego, Luna. Luna read from the book and led children through some simple dance moves, not unlike a traditional librarian-led Storytime. Varela-Cossack said that events like Drag Queen Storytimes are essential to supporting LGBTQ community members, especially children.
I mean, we have students who are transgender and identifying as transgender in our elementary schools in Ketchikan, Alaska. We are doing a disservice if we don't have events like this to show queer youth that there are queer adults in here who are living in town, who are living lives, who are living successful lives, who are living happy lives.
The debate over Pride programming comes as policymakers have scrutinized LGBTQ programming in schools and other public institutions, especially those aimed at children. A wave of legislation in states across the country has also sought to limit the rights of children to seek gender-affirming care or use public facilities corresponding to their gender identity. In Alaska, Governor Mike Dunleavy recently introduced a bill that would bar transgender students from using restrooms that match their gender identities and would limit students' ability to use their preferred names and pronouns in school without their parents' permission. Tully, the library director, said Friday morning that she plans to announce the time and date of the drag queen reading soon. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
The school year ends next month, and Dillingham School District is hiring new teachers. But with over a dozen positions to fill and faced with a national teacher shortage, KDLG's Christina McDermott reports that community members are worried.
In Dillingham, when school ends next month, students will pack up backpacks and head to summer vacation. They'll return in August to many new faces. As of Monday, the school district had 17 jobs posted on the Alaska Teacher Placement website. That's more than a quarter of its staff. At a recent city council meeting, Human Resources Director Lindsay Henry said Dillingham is a tough sell to potential new hires.
They are asking, what is your moving allowance? What are your incentives? What are your housing stipends? And we really don't have that to offer.
Teacher shortages, especially in rural Alaska, have made headlines for years. The problem, though, is national, and the shortage is a long time coming. Low wages and high stress levels, especially after the pandemic, are contributing to the decline. Teachers today earn a quarter less than other college graduates, and when you adjust for inflation, new teachers earn less than their older counterparts did starting out. At this city council meeting, elementary school principal Nick Tweet said between the level of pay offered, high costs, and the lack of housing, Dillingham's at a competitive disadvantage.
We don't pay as much as Anchorage. We don't pay as much as Southwest. We often get to the end of interviews and they ask about housing, you know, and that's a serious situation. Even when teachers, when we get young teachers here, it's hard to keep them here with the cost of living.
Superintendent Amy Brower said Dillingham's lack of housing was the reason some teachers turned down contracts last summer.
We actually offered six different people contracts during that time that they either signed and then withdrew from, or they didn't sign because as they started looking for housing, they could not find affordable, suitable housing for their needs.
Brower said the district is working to hire teachers earlier in the year so that they have more time to find housing. She said that along with posting jobs internally and externally, they're fostering relationships with colleges and universities in other states so that their job postings reach a wider audience. They're also looking to hire international teachers through a visa program. Dillingham parent Diana Schulmeyer works for Southwest Region School District, which serves seven communities in the region. She said they've been recruiting since last fall.
It is an ongoing yearly process. We start our recruiting in October and then really step it up in January, focusing on what career fairs we're going to go to.
At career fairs, competition for applicants can be fierce, Schulmeyer said. At one event she attended in Pennsylvania, more than 500 districts sought applicants. Schulmeyer believes part of the answer to this issue is convincing existing community members to help fill educational gaps. She says Alaska's emergency certification program is one way forward. It allows anyone with an associate's degree or higher to teach in their field.
And then we have teachers that have housing, that live here, that are committed, and they will hopefully stay for more than a year and teach our kids, because that longevity is important to our students and their learning.
Dillingham has worked with emergency certified teachers in the past, and anyone who is interested can get in touch with the school. Schulmeyer herself has volunteered to teach middle school math this upcoming year. In Dillingham, I'm Christina McDermott.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit rain.org. That's rain.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
A week after Anchorage's mail-in municipal election, nearly all progressive and moderate assembly candidates continue to hold comfortable leads over their challengers. City officials have counted about 54,000 of the 66,000 ballots they've received so far. Zach Johnson, a moderate from South Anchorage, currently holds an 8-point lead over his conservative challenger, Rachel Reese. He says he's not declaring victory just yet, but things are looking promising.
Certainly, we want to wait until every vote's counted to pop the champagne, but the results that we're looking at feel very encouraging.
Johnson is poised to join three other new assembly members who tend to support policies put forth by the body's left-of-center majority. The two incumbents in the assembly races also have strong leads, Felix Rivera and Chris Constant. Since Mayor Dave Bronson took office in 2021, the staunch conservative has often been at odds with the assembly's left-leaning majority. The sole conservative assembly candidate who's poised to win his race is Scott Myers, a realtor from Eagle River. Myers isn't surprised by the results, but is disappointed that his fellow conservative candidates didn't have similar luck. He says progressive campaigns had a strong showing in terms of money and backing from unions and other organizations. He didn't see that level of campaign support from Republicans.
It's almost inappropriate, in my opinion, and it's probably going to get me in trouble for saying so, but the Alaska Republican Party took zero interest in this local race.
With five new assembly members set to take their seats soon, Chris Constant, a North Anchorage assembly member, is hopeful that the group will inject new energy into the body.
I'm grateful that we have a bunch of fresh eyes coming onto the body, and that will bring a sense of that term renewal and new energy and fresh perspective, and hopefully help move us past some of just the conflicts that have arisen that now just seem like conflicts for conflict's sake.
The city clerk's office is continuing to update the election results daily. The results are set to be certified on April 25th. Cantwell-based musher Jesse Holmes won the Kobuk 440 sled dog race, arriving in Kotzebue on Sunday morning under clear skies and frigid conditions. This year's course followed the Kobuk River, carving a path through six villages in the Northwest Arctic before returning to Kotzebue. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
Kekik Tugruk Northern Lights dancers performed for a crowd of around 100 people at Kotzebue High School on Monday. The dancers were there to welcome the Kobuk 440 mushers before a she-fish banquet and awards ceremony. The Kobuk 440 is a 440-mile mid-distance race that typically lasts 4 to 5 days, with some sleep-deprived mushers arriving just hours before the awards ceremony. This year, 12 mushers completed the race, with no one scratching. Race organizer Paul Hansen says that's unique in the race's more than 30-year history.
I think that's the first time that we've ever had that happen, which is really awesome. You know, it's a kind of a testament to the guys running the race.
This year's winner, Cantwell-based musher Jesse Holmes, arrived in Kotzebue a little after 8 a.m. Sunday morning, 3 hours ahead of second-place finisher Richie Deal of Aniak. Arriving with his face covered in ice crystals, Holmes gave his dogs a snack and briefly posed for photos as spectators braved the minus 40-degree cold to greet him. The 41-year-old musher won the 2017 Kobuk 440 as a rookie, and after 5 Kobuk runs, 2 of which he scratched, Holmes says he's been chasing the feeling of that initial victory ever since.
It's a high that we're on, and we're going to keep that high going.
Although Holmes says his team was in good shape after their 5th place finish in this year's Iditarod, he says the Kobuk course was a challenge. The trails, well-worn from snow-go travel between the Arctic villages, posed a challenge for Holmes, who led the race early on.
Every time that a snow machine travels over a trail like that, it chews up the surface to where, you know, the dogs are now sinking in, you know, 4-6 inches in places where it gets all crystalled and sugared. So, you know, you're just constantly having to work hard and pull hard on a trail like that.
Holmes says despite some of the more treacherous trail conditions, the generosity of the villagers, who typically greet mushers at checkpoints with handmade fur and beaded gifts as well as homemade food, is one of his favorite aspects of the 440. That, and he says, the remote beauty along the trail.
It is just thrilling being out there in the wilderness. As I was coming to Onion Portage on the Kobuk River, that big red blood orange moon came out, and it was pretty striking.
Other mushers encountered difficulties along the way. Rookie Jeff Dieter of Fairbanks got a stomach bug and feared dehydration on the course. Red Lantern finisher Loro Eklund was given a common remedy by locals along the route to combat muscle cramps, earning him the nickname Mustard Shots. As the last finisher, he arrived in Kotzebue a little after 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon. Early on in the race, last year's Kobuk 440 winner Hugh Neff lost his dog team between Kiana and Ambler and was assisted by 3 mushers who helped him retrieve his team. Neff finished 4th this year out of 12 competitors. Canadian musher and this year's 3rd-place finisher Michelle Phillips was the first person to assist Neff on the trail.
He lost his team right behind me, and I automatically said hop on the sled because there's nothing else you'd do for anyone, you know. You've got to go get your dog team.
Phillips says she also carries an assortment of homeopathic herbs that she distributed to some of the mushers with minor ailments. She received the Sportsmanship Award in this year's race. Reporting in Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
And finally, we have a correction. A story we ran on Friday that said Apayuk Reitan was the first openly transgender musher to run the Iditarod. She was actually the first out trans woman to run. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Riley Board in Juneau, Casey Grove and Kavitha George in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Christina McDermott in Dillingham, and Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska Pacific University offers an education as an adventure in living and learning. Students are the core of APU, representing the aspirations and collective wisdom of our community. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Alaska's Indigenous heritage while offering a unique and powerful educational experience. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.